Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, Ethan Elkind. Tonight, we will look at our future in a world with self-driving cars, also known as autonomous vehicles. Self-driving cars are already prowling our streets and highways on trial runs, thanks to the many Bay Area companies racing to perfect this technology. Now, proponents of autonomous vehicles believe they could reduce the almost 31,000 traffic fatalities each year by three quarters, saving roughly 23,000 lives annually. If true, this reduction in fatalities would arguably make the use of driverless cars a moral imperative. Driverless cars could also offer independence to the physically impaired and elderly who are unable to drive themselves. Others, however, are uncomfortable with the idea of a car racing down a highway with no human at the wheel. Could these cars be turned into weapons by terrorists? What if there's a software glitch? Now, the news in the last few weeks has been full of stories indicating that the era of self-driving cars is inevitable and nearly upon us. In fact, just tonight, we've learned that the Obama administration will be promulgating some regulations to encourage the deployment of this technology among the states. But are we truly prepared for the changes this technology will bring? There are many questions we'll need to address before driverless cars become widespread. What are the implications for those who earn a living by driving, including with mass transit, long-haul trucking, and Uber drivers? If a driverless car crashes, who is liable? The software developer, the car manufacturer, the passenger, or someone else? And how will our cities change if driverless cars become widely adopted? Will traffic actually increase? The answers might surprise you. So to discuss all of this and more, I'm pleased to be joined in the studio tonight by Jerry Tierney, Associate Principal at Perkins & Will, Director of the firm's Smart Mobility Lab, studying the evolution of urban mobility and its impact on the public realm. A founder of Mobility in the city's Red Car Project, Jerry has collaborated with the University of California, Berkeley's Transportation Sustainability Research Center on workshops addressing mobility needs in many contexts. Welcome, Jerry.
Good evening.
And by phone, we're joined by Dorothy Glancy, professor of law at Santa Clara University. Known for her work in the area of privacy and transportation, Professor Glancy has researched privacy and intelligent transportation systems extensively. She was also a consultant to the Metropolitan Transportation Commission in the San Francisco Bay Area and has worked with the U.S. Department of Transportation regarding privacy policy issues as well as legal and regulatory issues. Welcome, Dorothy.
It's a pleasure to be here.
And finally, we're joined by phone by Susan Shaheen, PhD, co-director of the Transportation Sustainability Research Center and adjunct professor in civil and environmental engineering at the University of California, Berkeley. Dr. Shaheen was the first Honda Distinguished Scholar in Transportation at the Institute of Transportation Studies at UC Davis from 2000 to 2012, and her research projects on car sharing, smart parking, and older mobility have received national awards. Welcome, Susan.
Thank you.
And we invite you, our listeners, to join our conversation by dialing 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. Or you can email or text us now at cityvisions@kalw.org or post a comment on kalw.org or on our Facebook page. You can also reach us by tweeting us at cityvisionskalw. We want to hear about your feelings about a future with autonomous vehicles. We're interested in your thoughts on this topic, so please do reach out. So I want to get started with this conversation by just assessing the state of the technology. A lot of people think autonomous vehicles is a George Jetsons kind of future, but we're hearing so much that this actually may be a lot sooner than any of us have anticipated. So Susan Shaheen, let me start with you. When will people begin to get their own driverless car?
Well, that's a great question, and a lot of people are talking about it, as you mentioned. So that could be very soon, and we're already seeing automated vehicle, connected vehicle technology on the streets as we speak. So it could be as soon as 5 years, but I think it's a much more complicated question about access to the rights of way and use of those vehicles.
Mm-hmm. And Dorothy Glancy at Santa Clara University Law School, what's your take on when we might be seeing these vehicles, these fully autonomous vehicles hitting the road?
Well, I think the technology's ready to go. I'm not sure that the regulatory system is quite ready for it. Right now, you can't own a driverless car, and under the Department of Motor Vehicles' proposed draft regulations, you will not be able to own one even when they become street legal.
Mm-hmm.
So it seems to me that there are a lot of sort of practical details that haven't been worked out, especially by regulatory agencies. It seems to me that the technologies are developing extremely quickly and are really a good bit better than the legal and regulatory systems are.
So one of those practical details that the policy arena has to address is about safety. And Jerry Tierney, I would love to hear from you, first of all, if you agree with that assessment about when, you know, the technology already here. But secondly, when are people going to be safe in these vehicles?
Well, I let you know that in Helsinki right now, they're actually doing a pilot study where they've rolled out two self-driving buses in a neighborhood of Helsinki. They have a thing called the Easy Mile EZ10. It's an electric minibus. And this is part of a study that the European Commission has been doing over the last 4 years. They've been beta testing this around several cities in Europe. It's now fetched up in Helsinki. They're running it in a neighborhood in Helsinki. And they're basically out there with a fully autonomous vehicle that is picking up passengers. And while they were beta testing it over the last 4 years, it's carried a total of around about 75,000 plus people without incident. So autonomous vehicles carrying people on roadways is, in fact, taking place right now. Maybe not in North America, but certainly in Europe, in Helsinki, this is going on right now. Now, when do we have the technology for the private automobile, if it is going to be a private automobile? I think we're still a ways away. I think Susan is right. We're at least 5, maybe 10 years. I mean, we see various forms of autonomous features coming into cars right now. But when you get the full packet, I've got to say you're probably at least 10 years out. When will the customer fully accept that? When will the consumer finally accept that? Maybe that's going to be longer. I'm not sure. But I think people might just see there's a lot of benefit in these autonomous vehicles, and you have to look at the ownership model if the manufacturers are going to be rolling out autonomous vehicles, not on a for sale basis, but maybe as part of a fleet, as part of a subscription service for an auto manufacturer, like for General Motors or Ford. You basically get a subscription. I think people will then take it up faster than we are prepared to kind of believe right now. For instance, we hear of Ford teaming up with Chariot Bus here in San Francisco. We hear of General Motors working with Lyft. We hear of them talking about in 5 years' time that they would have autonomous versions of Lyft vehicles and the Chariot Bus. I think when people get acclimated to riding around in these vehicles, I think you're going to see a faster rate of pickup and acceptance of this.
So you've touched on some of the benefits. And Dr. Susan Shaheen at the UC Berkeley Transportation Sustainability Research Center, I'd love to hear your take on what those benefits are. Why should we be excited about the idea of these fully autonomous vehicles coming soon to a driveway near us?
Well, one thing I wanted to make sure that you're aware of and the audience was aware of is I'm an expert in shared vehicle services. I've been studying them for over 20 years. And so a lot of my comments are going to be, specifically when I bring in data, are going to be very specific to the benefits and the modeling results, because there's been a lot of hard research on this in the context of shared vehicles. I'm pretty sure that Jerry is going to talk about shared automated vehicles as well. So in that context, the idea of a shared fleet, so not necessarily privately owned or could be put into a peer-to-peer context, similar to like a Lyft driver who's driving their own personal vehicle or an Uber vehicle that's being driven by a private individual using that vehicle. So that could be a shared automated fleet. It could also be owned by a company. And we're very familiar with those types of services. Zipcar is one of the biggest names in the business in car sharing, and that's essentially a third party operating a fleet. So the business models are of interest, but the focus here is your question on potential benefits. In a shared automated vehicle context, we have seen research on modeling from across the globe that suggests a reduction in greenhouse gas emissions. And we're also hearing a lot about how it could reduce per mile costs over privately owned vehicles. And there's an opportunity to also look at density and how we use land use. So particularly in the context of a shared automated vehicle system deployed in an urban core, are we going to need all of this parking infrastructure? Or are we going to need to start turning that parking structure, those parking structures over to other types of land uses like parks and affordable housing? can we take that on-street parking space and convert it to curb space? Because when you think about a shared automated vehicle system, we're going to have access to a lot of curb space for drop-off and pick-up. So I think one of the benefits of shared automated vehicles, right, is this idea that we can really start looking at our land use very differently. And this would also potentially enable households to reduce the size of their transportation budgets. It's the second largest household expenditure today. Could they reduce the number of privately owned vehicles in their household overall? And also in the context, and this is my final point on sharing, could we right-size these vehicles? Could we right-size these vehicles to the trip? So a majority of trips are single-person trips. Could these vehicles be converted to single-pod style vehicles, thus reducing their footprint overall, along with their energy use and their emissions? You know, the second bigger category of vehicle trips is two-person trips. Could we create two-passenger vehicles? So this is the notion of right-sizing the vehicle in the context of a shared automated system, and what are all of those associated benefits?
Mm-hmm. So lots of potential upside here. We already have a caller, Ruth Ann from El Cerrito. Ruth Ann, welcome to City Visions. It looks like we lost Ruth Ann. So let me go to Professor Dorothy Clancy at Santa Clara University Law School. We've heard from other two guests potential upsides, potential benefits of driverless cars. What do you see as some of the potential upsides that haven't been mentioned so far?
Well, it seems to me that there are a great many sort of environmental benefits, social benefits, and the like. But we really are faced with actually getting these vehicles on the road. And there are a number of public policy decisions that are still pending that no one has made that sort of stand in the way of getting any of these vehicles on the roads of the United States. Other countries may find them more easily integrated into their ground transportation space, but in this country we have a highly regulated system, and it's making it extremely difficult to actually bring these cars to actual users. My guess is that something like the car ownership model may well be something that goes away anyway, whether the cars are autonomous or not. But we need to build some networks to make possible the safer self-driving cars, and we simply don't have those networks yet. The sort of policy decisions that have been trying to work toward them have kind of stalled out, it seems to me. One of the things that I think is interesting is maybe we're thinking too narrowly about the promise of autonomous cars. Maybe autonomous cars or autonomous personal mobility, it doesn't need to be a motor vehicle. That is, we haven't talked about whether they'll be electric or combustion or hydrogen-powered or whatever they're powered by, but maybe they're a completely different category. And I think some of Susan's work is really interesting because a lot of the sort of fleets of vehicle sharing, I think Audi has an arrangement, an experimental arrangement, to provide vehicles for people who work at particular for particular employers. All kinds of sort of inventive ways of sharing them. But it seems to me that we need some sort of better sorting out of whether autonomous cars need to be continued to be regulated as motor vehicles, or maybe there's something that's completely different.
So lots of questions about the technology, and I want to get to that, but Ruth Ann from El Cerrito is back with us. So Ruth Ann, thank you for calling into City Visions.
Oh, hi there. Thank you very, very much. I wanted to comment and ask the guests. I'm a person with a physical disability. I used to drive, and it was really easy. I hopped into the car, pulled my wheel. I use a wheelchair. I have spinal cord injury. And it's since progressed that I've had lots of surgery, and now I have a back brace, and it's too complicated to do. So I am no longer driving. I would love to have the option of an autonomous vehicle.
So let me thank you for that question, Ruth. And let me pass that one over to Jerry Tierney. What's your response?
Definitely. I think that this is going to be something for people who are, for one reason or another, cannot, you know, drive their own car, drive their own vehicle. I think this is really a tremendous opportunity here. But moving along from that, I think a couple of good points have come up from Dr. Glancy and Dr. Shaheen. And really, we're talking about ownership. And we can see that right now, regardless of whether the vehicles are autonomous, we're really moving into a different kind of paradigm of vehicle ownership. Dr. Glancy had mentioned the Audi experiment. In fact, you can go into downtown San Francisco and you can see billboards for a high-rise tower down near the Transbay Center. And on that big billboard, it says, if you move into this particular high-rise tower, you get a subscription to Audi, and they will actually valet you the vehicle that you want. And it's a bit to Professor Shaheen's point about right-sizing a vehicle, although at this point it's probably, if you want to go out on a hot date, you get the sports car, and if you want to go up to Tahoe, you get the SUV, which is probably not quite what Dr. Shaheen was talking about. But it shows you that the car manufacturers are moving away from you going down to the showroom and purchasing a particular model. And really what you're doing is it's kind of the Netflixization of auto ownership. You're basically going to subscribe to Audi or Volkswagen or to Ford or GM and get the vehicles that you want at that particular time. Now, whether that vehicle comes to you autonomously or whether it's valeted, really what you're talking about here is a change in ownership structure. And I think that's really, really important. And also we mentioned about networks. I think if we're going to be talking about this working successfully, we have to talk about a system that is networked, and that, of course, talks about policy. But what we've seen from the likes of Uber is that we see the technology and the business model running ahead of policy. And of course, I'm not advocating the Uber approach, but essentially their approach was you came into a city, you set up the Uber system, and then you begged forgiveness later and worked out the details. I think you're going to see more and more of that, that the policymakers are going to be playing catch-up continuously. And I think technology and the consumers and the marketplace are going to move ahead of the policymakers, and they're going to be in a perpetual state of catch-up unless they realize this is coming, this is a tsunami that's on its way, let's get real about it, and let's start talking about it now.
So it's definitely a fast-changing landscape, and it's easy to picture, as you all described, some of these upsides here, the potential benefits that we could all get, certainly from Ruth Ann, for example, someone who's impaired who can now drive. But what about this idea that, you know, from an environmental perspective, this may be a sort of dystopian future, especially if people are summoning all these vehicles at once? Is this going to lead to increased traffic congestion? Is it going to lead to more driving miles? And let me pass that over to Dr. Shaheen, since you've researched this car-sharing model. How feasible is this? What's this going to do for our urban footprint and our emissions profile and overall driving miles?
Right. So I think as we move into a discussion that shifts a little bit more to dystopia, Professor Glancy has talked a lot about the regulatory environment, a lot of the things that I think need to be sorted out that can essentially delay progress in this area. But I think one of the issues that comes up a lot and Jerry and I work together quite closely, and this is coming up in a lot of our discussions, is this concept of latent demand. And for those of you who haven't heard about it, this is the idea of demand being awoken. So suddenly now, we don't have to walk. We don't have to ride a bike. We just go from point to point, and it's really easy. Does that potentially result in a lot of consumption of vehicle miles traveled? And how does that play out? And I've talked about a shared automated world in which I think you could get closer to utopia. In a less utopian world, perhaps a dystopic world, everybody has their own private automated vehicle. They jump in it, and they can potentially live further and further out away from the city. They can sleep in the vehicle. They can do work in the vehicle. They can do essentially anything in this vehicle, and the vehicle will take them to work, and then it could potentially come home. Well, what does that do to our roadways? What does that do to congestion? Have we essentially created even more appetite for what we call vehicle miles traveled? Does this take people out of active transportation modes? So now they're not walking as much. They don't know they're riding bikes as much. And what is it doing in terms of public transit as well as other legacy modes like taxi providers? how does this all play out is, I think, a really fascinating question that a lot of us are working on.
Mm-hmm. Well, lots of interesting issues to discuss there. This is City Visions on local public radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. Well, our regular listeners know that we are in the middle of our fall pledge drive, and we are honored to be joined by regular City Visions host Joseph Pace, who's in the studio tonight. So you're getting a tag team host in the studio.
Hey there, Ethan.
Good to see you, Joseph. Why don't you tell listeners all about this this pledge drive and what we need from them for their support?
Well, if you go to 1-800-525-9917 or klw.org, you can make a donation to keep shows like City Visions on the air. It's great to be here with you, Ethan. Great show tonight. Talking about the kind of innovation and the kind of things that we do here in the Bay Area. This is what makes KLW special, what makes City Vision special, and what makes the Bay Area special. So we're looking for 7 clicks or calls in this hour, 2 new members for our new member Monday, and that's at 1-800-525-9917 or KALW.org.
You know, this is a Bay Area show that we're doing tonight. I mean, a lot of this technology, driverless technology, it's coming right out of the Bay Area, center of innovation. And here we get to have an opportunity to discuss with some of the leading thinkers on this issue, right where this issue is making a global impact. And we'd love to get your support. We'd love to have you call in or email in and sign up, join up with KLW.
This is KLW's 75th and membership drive. And it's remarkable that it actually happens to fall on the 25th. Anniversary of City Visions. And City Visions is part of a long line of public affairs programming here at KALW. And so every gift counts. Every gift shows your support for this kind of locally produced independent programming. Almost 2/3 of our funding comes from you, our listeners. Mm-hmm. So show that support by going to klw.org or by dialing 1-800-525-9917. Now back to City Visions.
Great. Well, thank you, Joseph. So this is City Visions on local public radio. You're joining tonight listening to a conversation about self-driving cars, autonomous vehicles. Joining us in the studio is Jerry Tierney, associate principal at architectural and design firm Perkins & Will. Joining us by phone, Dorothy Glancy, professor of law at Santa Clara University, and Susan Shaheen, joining us also by phone, co-director of the Transportation Sustainability Research Center, an adjunct professor in civil and environmental engineering at the University of California, Berkeley. We'd love for you to call in with your questions or comments. We want to hear about your concerns about autonomous vehicles, your hopes and dreams about autonomous vehicles, what you see as their potential benefits. The number to call in to join this conversation is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. You can also email or text us at cityvisions@kalw.org or post a comment on kalw.org or on our Facebook page. And you can also reach us on Twitter by using @cityvisions@kalw. So we have another caller on the line, Joel. Welcome to City Visions.
Hello. Yes. With driverless cars, there seems to be an opportunity that, although there are many possible problems, there's an opportunity that people haven't been talking about very much, and it gets me really excited to think about, and that is the effect on our healthcare system. Because when you have a driverless car, one of the big issues legally is who's responsible if someone's injured. So then you have a situation where there's pressure on the national healthcare policy to make it so that nobody has to fight it out who it is that's responsible for a given injury. And that might change, or that might be one of the many factors in our society that, especially the automation element of our society, that change how pressure builds towards a single-payer type system. I mean, there are lots of issues that that I think are even bigger than the issue of who's responsible for someone being injured. That might prevent the driverless system from ever going where all the dreamers want it to go. But anyway, if that does happen, that would be very exciting to me.
Interesting. Sure, thank you. Interesting question about healthcare, but also liability. And we know this is an area that Professor Dorothy Glancy at Santa Clara University has studied. Professor Glancy, what are we going to do in terms of this liability situation if we have an accident, which we're seems inevitable that we're going to have with an autonomous vehicle? How do we work through that liability and who's at fault? And do you see a connection there to our healthcare system? system dynamic?
There's sort of a couple of things. One, the chances are that the legal system will work out responsibility for accidents pretty much as they have been doing. Automobile accidents are an area where there's a lot of products liability that pays for at least part of the cost insofar as there's something wrong with the vehicle. The trouble with autonomous vehicles is if they get into car crashes, the causes of those crashes are likely to be so complicated that it may not be possible to sort out who or what specific technology was responsible for the car crash. You think about the Toyota unanticipated acceleration. No one is quite sure exactly what caused those particular car crashes. And my sense is that the sort of complicated technologies with regard to autonomous vehicles is likely to result in these incredibly complicated fact patterns. So I think Joel has a really good idea, which is to perhaps have some kind of no-fault insurance, which manufacturers would, of course, pay partially into. The manufacturer Volvo has said that if there are car crashes that are caused by its vehicles, that it will pick up the liability for them. And my sense is that many of the other car manufacturers would also be responsible. But the trouble is that maybe it's even sort of bigger than the car companies. A number of us who work on the legal side of autonomous vehicles at Santa Clara have been looking at the possibility of a system which is very much like the way that we deal with childhood vaccines, where you have a no-fault payment of all of the costs that are caused, all the medical costs that are caused by this technology or this pharmaceutical, and that is paid out of a fund that is put together by a tax on the sales of these items. Seems to be that's one model that I think Joel would think would be a good one.
Mm-hmm. And Jerry Tierney, you mentioned this Helsinki project, and maybe others that you've studied as well. It's also a question I'd like to ask Dr. Shaheen as well. How is liability, or is it factored into some of these initial pilot projects?
I can't really comment about the legal system or the insurance system in Finland or other European countries, other than it obviously had government involvement, and maybe there's a single point of payer there. I think we're bringing up some good points.
This is Dorothy. It's part of sort of general commercial liability, and insofar as the state is involved, there's also provision for that as well. If there are accidents, people will be cared for, but that varies from place to place. I agree with you, Jerry.
Mm-hmm. Well, great. Good. Thank you for clarifying that, Professor Glancy. And Jerry, just staying on you for a moment, we sort of left before the break there, the pledge break, describing some of the potential negatives, and you didn't get a chance to weigh in on that. You talked a lot about the positives and some of the unknowns, but what would sort of keep you awake at night about autonomous vehicles?
Susan's dystopia of people living in their cars. I mean, that may well appeal to a certain segment of the population, but I mean, anybody who's been on a long-haul flight or even a short-haul flight around the country or overseas knows that there's a kind of a limit to the amount of time one can spend inside a kind of a cigar canister, regardless of how plush and how much TV and how much internet surfing you can do in there. So I think that people will basically, maybe for novelty purposes, you know, do that for a couple of weeks and then tire of it and want to get back to the real world of living. So, you know, we talk about this dystopia of everybody taking these little vehicles around, but let's look at from another point of view. Dr. Shaheen had pointed out about right-sizing the vehicles and the amount of real estate that these vehicles take up. And we talk about the efficiency of how they use the actual road space. And so let's say that this increase in efficiency is 100-200% increase of efficiency of the actual asphalt. And so we have to look at this in a city. What is the right speed of vehicles going through a city? I mean, currently the way we design cities, the traffic engineers – feel that everybody is entitled to go through downtown San Francisco at 30, 35 miles an hour. And how realistic is that for a major metropolitan area? Is it perfectly fine to have people go through at a steady, say, 15 miles an hour? So the point being is, rather than looking at a roadway as just simply kind of more cars down a street, maybe what we say is, like, we take the efficiency that we've gained from these smaller sized vehicles, these vehicles that can operate closer together, have narrower road lanes, and we take the surplus asphalt, as it were, and give it over to other means of transportation. I mean, we have bike lanes, make the sidewalks more walkable. I mean, we're familiar with walking around streets in South of Market, and I like it, say, on 3rd Street in San Francisco here, where we come out of the SF MoMA onto a sidewalk that's only about 10 feet wide. You feel like if you tripped on your shoelace, you'd end up in front of a muni bus. I mean, really, that should be an open kind of a plaza area instead of 3rd Street heading up towards Market Street being 6 lanes wide. Why couldn't that street be, say, 2 lanes wide for vehicles and the other lanes given over to, say, bike? People could be skateboarding, they can be on other devices, or they could be simply walking. We have the ability here to make our downtowns, our urban areas, more attractive to walk. And I mean, part of the reason why people don't walk so much in North American cities is that it's a pretty hostile environment, because you're being asked to walk down these narrow, relatively narrow sidewalks alongside what I would call a traffic sewer. A lot of these streets are one-way streets, 5 lanes wide, with cars kind of racing the red light ahead, you know, so that they can all beat the lights. And, you know, it is not an attractive environment. And yet when we go to a European city and we find ourselves walking kind of all day long, it's because fundamentally it's just a more walkable, more attractive environment to get out and walk.
So a car technology that can encourage people to walk. That's
absolutely
an interesting point.
It really is. It's sort of a back to the future.
Yeah.
And I'd also say that here that there's – and I recommend that a lot of your listeners do this. Go onto YouTube. And you can go on YouTube and look for the Journey Down Market Street. It's a black and white silent movie that was made on the eve of the 06 earthquake, where they put a camera in front of a streetcar going down Market Street. And a lot of people look at this movie and they look at it to see what does San Francisco look like literally on the eve of the 06 earthquake, and they're checking out the buildings. When I look at that, I see, how did people actually use the public realm? How did they use the street before there was the automobile, when there was only the streetcar and horse and buggies and people on bicycles and other people walking? In other words, the pace of the transportation going down that street was little more than walking pace. It was about 15 miles an hour, let's say, for a streetcar. And you find that people are just walking all over the place, and you suddenly realize, historically, this is the way we have used downtowns prior to the advent of the automobile, that when we were on a street and we saw somebody across the street, you walked across the street. You saw a storefront across the street, you walked across the street. You didn't have to walk down to the end of the block, wait for the light to change, and then cross, and then come back up. I mean, you basically had free rein throughout downtown. So this is back to the future, is what I'm advocating.
Exactly. It sounds like we're going right back to the future, and this is City Visions on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KLW San Francisco, and on the web at klw.org. Our guest tonight, we're talking autonomous vehicles. We have Jerry Tierney in the studio with design firm Perkins & Will, Dorothy Glancy from Santa Clara University Law School, and Dr. Susan Shaheen from the UC Berkeley Transportation Sustainability Research Center. Dr. Shaheen, since you focus a lot of your study on these car-sharing fleets and the way autonomy could interact with them, I'd like to ask you to help us give a sense of the larger transportation picture. Now, Jerry just talked about public transit and how that might actually potentially be benefited by having autonomous vehicles in terms of encouraging pedestrians and biking. What do you make of how autonomous vehicles might affect public transit in this country?
Right, and this is a big focus of the research that we're engaged in at UC Berkeley. And now a lot of our research is not on automated vehicles in practice, right, because we are really looking at how existing shared vehicle systems are interfacing with public transit. We've looked extensively at round-trip car sharing, one-way car sharing. You might not know it, but we are currently conducting, I believe, the first study of Lyft and Uber in conjunction with the Natural Resources Defense Council to look at the impacts of these systems. And it's a very complex calculation. It involves a lot of user surveys. Sometimes we need to do driver surveys. In the case of an Uber in a Lyft-type model. We need to actually talk to the drivers, see what they're driving. And we also use what we call activity data. So this is live data off of the system to help us to calibrate and measure. So, you know, what we know about some of the existing research is that when we look at urban core areas where there's a lot of services, we tend to see that bike sharing and car sharing systems can compete with existing public transit lines, but they can also serve as first mile, last mile feeder services. And so what we're really keen to understand is how much of this is really changing or altering behavior. In our round trip car sharing research from North America, we found that either it's a neutral or negative effect, and it's not terribly a large effect. We've also looked at this in North America, Canada, the U.S., Mexico, in terms of the implications for how does like a bike sharing service. Now, I'm not advocating for an automated bike sharing service, but it's interesting to see how it affects human behavior. It gives us a sense of how it might affect human behavior in an automated vehicle world. And what we see with bike sharing is really interesting because we had better data that allowed us to do analysis with GIS on a mapping system. And what we see is that when you're in a more urban core area where there's a lot of choices, these systems may, again, it depends on how you view the world, compete with public transit. But when we look at these services in less dense areas, they tend to be a magnet towards public transit, so they actually increase public transit ridership. And in areas like Minneapolis, St. Paul, where we studied it, where they have a less networked and dense public transit system, throughout the entire system, bike sharing served as a feeder. So I think a really interesting question here is a policy question, and maybe this is more up Professor Glancy's alley, is, you know, what type of policies do we need to put in place to help steer and guide towards greater social and environmental benefits? What role might policies play to ensure that these services are augmenting public transit, and that is still a serious backbone of our transportation system? But in areas where public transit isn't performing as well, for example, I know we've all seen empty buses, particularly in suburban areas, could we take those types of services and replace them with shared automated shuttles? So downsize the vehicle, I've already talked about right-sizing that vehicle, and putting it in an automated vehicle system that could help serve as a collector service to get us to those BART lines, to get us to those Caltrain lines in those more suburban areas. So I think this is really a big question of policy.
So it sounds like policy is really going to be critical to managing the impacts of this new technology. And on that subject, Professor Dorothy Glancy at Santa Clara Law School, interested what you're seeing as some of the emerging policy ideas to try to, you know, potentially head off some of the negative impacts of this technology and instead encourage some of the positive ones related to boosting public transit, related to encouraging biking, walking, and maybe reining in sprawl development as well.
Lots of things that can be done to use autonomous vehicles, which at least it looks like millennials are likely to choose to use, to have them as a kind of a lure to live in more urbanized, more dense areas, and providing them with the kind of sort of transportation that they need. I was looking earlier today at a new book from Edward Humes called Door to Door, and maybe that's part of what is in my sort of background thoughts about this, because it seems like at least Americans, anyway, North Americans, believe that they have some kind of right to have door-to-door mobility. And tend to be somewhat shy of using more than one form of transportation. The people at the University of Minnesota have been looking at using kind of feeder systems and the like, and people are more reluctant to use those than they are a kind of transportation that moves them from their residence door to their office door. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me that if that is, if that's so about human nature, then maybe one of the things that an urban center could do would be to provide that door-to-door kind of transportation, but only through autonomous and probably electric vehicles to make them more environmentally sound. Urban cores can sort of zone themselves with regard to different kinds of transportation options. We have, you know, pedestrian malls. We have transit malls already in the United States, and many more of them, of course, in Europe. But we could use the autonomous vehicles as a mode of door-to-door transportation to encourage people to live in more densely settled sort of urban areas.
So lots of options for our...
We still end up with this sense that I have a right to travel by myself from my door to my door, and I know that Susan has been studying this as well. One of the things that came across my desk this morning was an ordinance in the city of Chicago, which is talking about outlawing autonomous vehicles in the city of Chicago. And it strikes me that kind of a reaction by some local governments, some of them very large, like Chicago, might be something that we need to deal with.
So lots of options are at the local level, and sounds like some good models then for people interested in these issues. You're listening to City Visions on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. Just want to remind our listeners, you're welcome to join this conversation by dialing 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134, or feel free to email or text us at cityvisions@kalw.org, or post a comment on kalw.org. Think of those questions while we go back to Joseph Pacci, once again here in the studio, joining me, talking about our fall membership drive. Joseph.
Hey, Ethan. I invite you, our listeners, to go to your phone and call 1-800-525-9917, or you can click on kalw.org to show your support tonight on New Member Monday during our 75th and membership drive here on KALW. Today only, all new members can receive our enhanced new member pack, which includes a KALW bumper and bike sticker, a lightweight foldable KALW tote bag, a full set of 3 KALW refrigerator magnets, and these are some solid magnets, let me tell you, and they are great designs. We're looking for 2 new members in this hour. You can join us at 1-800-525-9917 or donate at kalw.org.
And you're getting a 2-for-1 special tonight. We got 2 City Vision hosts in the studio. We want you to call in. That number again is 1-800-525-9917, or feel free to visit the website at kalw.org. And, you know, we're talking autonomous vehicles. Maybe in a few years, people can actually call in and join KLW while the car is driving for them.
Yeah, you don't have to pull over anymore. If you have been listening to KLW for a while, or you've just discovered us recently, but you've never given, make this the time for you to go from being a listener to being a participant in local public radio. Again, that number, 1-800-525-9917, or the website, kalw.org. Back to Ethan.
All right. Thank you, Joseph. And once again, City Visions on Local Public Radio. We're talking about self-driving cars. We're talking about autonomous vehicles. We have joining us today in the studio is Jerry Tierney with Perkins & Will. We have Dorothy Glancy by phone from Santa Clara University Law School, and Susan Shaheen at UC Berkeley's Transportation Sustainability Research Center. I just want to remind everyone, you're welcome to call with questions before the hour's up at 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Again, you can email or text us at cityvisions@kalw.org. I want to go to Jerry Tierney on this question of policies. You've described this, you know, again, back to the sort of utopian idea of how we can shrink our streets and allow more pedestrian activity, going back to that YouTube video on Market Street in 1906. What do you see as a priority for policymakers to try to help ensure that that reality, that that vision becomes a reality and not a more negative one?
No, this is a really excellent and important question. I think we have to, on one hand, redefine what we mean by transit, and also, in other words, the public works department, the traffic departments that look after our downtowns. we really not need to start thinking of those departments as the custodians of the public realm, and the redefined transit away from somebody who runs, say, a fixed infrastructure, the buses, the train or the subway or the streetcar, and looking at the totality of all the mobility options. So I think that at a very high level, we have to start redefining these things, because really, you know, we start looking at the policy and legislation that's in place right now. It was for, and it is for, kind of a paradigm which is going to change and radically change, and how we view operating in a city. And I think we're just becoming that much more sophisticated about how we live in a city and what we want out of a city and what we expect from a city. And, you know, mobility and transportation and transit is only one portion. Getting around is only one portion. It's the quality of life in that city. When we walk out the front door of our house and onto a street, we expect certain things now. We want the corner grocery store. We don't want the large Walmarts out there where we have to drive out to the suburbs. We want to be able to go down into a more kind of a nuanced neighborhood. And I think that this is going to call for a kind of a policy on a very high level. And I know I'm not getting into the specifics on this, but I think we have to sort of start looking first. The politicians have to start looking at reinventing, you know, what it is to be a Department of Transportation. Is it solely just a Department of Transportation, or maybe the Department of the Public Realm, that where transportation is only one portion of what goes on in the space between the buildings? And I think that's a discussion that we have to have. And until such time as we start, you know, reinventing these things, I think we're just going to be coming up with little Band-Aid solutions, and we're going to be in a reactive mode to what the consumers will be doing.
So we have an email comment here from Gary, who says that all major cities have nowhere to grow when it comes down to managing auto traffic except for up. And Gary believes that roads are going to eventually become double-decker, and at that point, autonomous cars can have their own lanes. Dr. Susan Shaheen, what do you make of that? And, you know, on this point about controlling the negative impacts, I'm also interested in your take on how we might limit the potential for sprawl from some of these autonomous vehicles. And so wondering if you could kind of answer both of those questions, Gary's comment about whether or not we're going to have to double-deck and have autonomous cars in their own lanes, and what we can do to contain the sprawl that would result.
Right. Well, I think this is a great point, and this gets to the matter of latent demand. And if we create more and more capacity, what we've learned from highway building is that we will create more demand, and eventually the congestion will come. So I'm not quite convinced that double-decker roads building upward is going to solve congestion, because we may just create more demand. And elevating vehicles from the roadway is an interesting concept in terms of eliminating or discouraging people from active transportation. But I do think ultimately this comes back to policy. Do we use specific zoning in the core of a city to say there's places where these types of vehicles are allowed? This is where you can access the curb space to dock and to let your passenger out. We really need to think through the speed of these vehicles. Perhaps we want to limit the speed of these vehicles in downtown areas, because that's going to lead to more safety and perhaps more livability for individuals. So I think I'm going to hearken back to my remarks about the policy realm, and that we really need to think through what kind of world do we want to live in. I think a lot of us in transportation and in planning who've been talking a lot about this new change to our transportation system think about this as an opportunity to really rethink the role of the car. The car is dominating our transportation and mobility systems in countries throughout the world, and in particular in the United States. Is this an opportunity to really rethink our relationship with that car, the role of the car? Do we really want to encourage private vehicle ownership with an automated vehicle? Do we really want to allow these vehicles to have access to our cities at any time of day? Do we really want to think about zoning? And do we really want to think about pricing? And do we really want to encourage more high-occupant vehicles through more of a shared model that is right-sized for time of day, location, and trip type?
So lots of important issues there for us to really be thinking about at a very sort of basic level. And one of those issues that we haven't touched on yet is this idea of terrorism or cybersecurity. If you have a robot computer driving your car, what is the possibility for a terrorist hacking them and turning it into a weapon, or just some other sort of cruel prank that might result from cybersecurity breaches? And Dorothy Glancy, I think a lot of this has to do with our regulatory system, how we set up our laws, and with your position at Santa Clara University Law School, is this an issue that you've looked into, and how do you respond when people talk about the terrorism and cybersecurity threats with these vehicles?
Yes, it's something that I have studied quite a bit. One of the kind of moments of interest is the recent DEF CON, the Hackers Conference, had a whole section devoted to hacking cars. And those are automated cars. Those are they could be autonomous cars. The fact is that the more automation that's built into a car, the more the vehicle is exposed to either tampering from outside or some of the cybersecurity concerns about autonomous cars is someone might just load one up with a bomb and send it toward a destination that they did not like. There's a number of sort of serious safety and security problems that are posed by autonomous cars, and they're things that we need to look at. One of the questions that still has to be asked about autonomous cars is whether they will communicate with each other, and if they do communicate with each other, how they'll communicate with each other. Some of the automobile manufacturers and some of the theorists are talking about using ordinary sort of internet connections between cars, and we already know from the hacking of the Jeep Cherokee last year and other sort of hacking events of cars that having an internet connection in a vehicle can open that vehicle to tampering from outside, either somebody who's trying to have some sort of malicious fun with it, but also someone who actually wishes someone harm. So something needs to be done about it. The automobile manufacturers are working on these security issues, but one of the difficulties in making public policy around security is that precisely what the requirements are probably is not the right topic for public discussion.
Wow, so lots of important issues there to think about, and certainly some potentially fearful scenarios that we would need to get ahead of. Perhaps on a less frightening note, I wanted to ask Jerry Tierney about parking, which actually for some people is maybe more of a nightmare situation. And when we think about this technology being introduced, and you're on the sort of land use policy, or I say land use design side of things, what do you envision as a future of parking? Are we going to have these vehicles just out and about circulating all day waiting for someone to summon them?
Parking is, they say in architecture, parking is form follows parking is the joke we have, because first thing we have to do when a client comes to us is figure out how much parking we can put on their property. But no, we see this going away, and we see this going away right now because parking demand in metropolitan areas is dropping. We see this in San Francisco. We see this in suburbia. We see that the demand for parking is dropping. And we're also meeting with clients who see, is there an exit strategy for their parking structures? We've actually had clients who have structured parking structures asking, you know, can they adapt those to housing or to commercial office space? And really, you can't. We have other clients who are about to build large parking structures, and we have to start considering about it, can they be adapted in the future or could they be recycled? But ultimately, with autonomous vehicles, I mean, the goal here is to reduce parking. And there was a study done, a modeling done by the OECD. They were using Lisbon. This came out just at the end of August. And they were basing a model of Lisbon using shared taxis and shared sort of minibuses. And in their modeling of this, they were reducing the parking by 95%. Well, and I don't know, that might work in Lisbon. Maybe when we bring it to North America, it changes to another number. But we're going to see parking reduced significantly. So it's going to free up the parking lots, the surface parking lots, obviously become an opportunity to start densifying our city, either through residential or commercial. And obviously then the street side parking goes away. But as Dr. Sheen mentioned earlier, though, that goes away, but now we have to look at drop-off and pickup zones. So we're currently doing a study right now through our mobility lab with another consulting firm, Arup, and we're looking at how much space on a street will be freed up from parking, but how much space equally will we need for a pickup and drop-off of these vehicles.
And we've got about a minute left, but I wanted to turn that same question over to Susan Shaheen. Susan, what do you think is going to be the future for parking in autonomous vehicles?
Well, I think there's tremendous potential to reclaim critical land use that is dedicated to these parking structures, as Jerry has alluded to. We worked at UC Berkeley recently on the Smart City Challenge with the City of San Francisco, and there was a vision of shared electric, connected, and automated vehicles. And as we phased through cycles of the vision for this, ultimately we had a vision that we would reclaim these parking garages and turn them over to affordable housing. Mm-hmm. And we'd be able to reclaim a lot of on-street parking and turn it into parklets. And we would really rethink the use of the curb space. So I echo Jerry's sentiment that we really do need to start thinking through how we're using our land use and what types of environments are we creating for the people that live and work and travel to our city.
So it's a very positive way to end the discussion. That's City Visions for this evening. Our guests tonight were Jerry Tierney with Perkins & Will, Dorothy Glancy, professor of law at Santa Clara University, and Susan Shaheen with UC Berkeley. Thanks to all of you for joining me this evening. For a link to this and other City Visions shows, to let us know what you thought about tonight's program, and to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, visit the City Visions page on kalw.org. Our engineer this evening was David LaTulipe. Tonight's show was produced by Wendy Holcomb and Chris Nooney. Please join us in 2 weeks. We're off for the presidential debate next week. But in 2 weeks, we'll be back on City Visions to talk about the proliferation of San Francisco ballot measures. This is Ethan Elkind. Thanks for listening. Good night, and have a great week.